Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, February 19th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined Lent, Decatur, A Call to Turn Back to God. St. Patrick Catholic Church marks Ash Wednesday by Valerie Wells, Decatur. Last year, Madison Davis gave up soda for Lent and never started drinking it again. This year, she's giving up candy, which won't be easy, she acknowledged, but if it isn't difficult, it's not really a sacrifice. It's important to observe Lent because we get more interactive with God, said Madison, an eighth grader at St. Patrick's School. Because of how Jesus was nailed to the cross and how he suffered for us, and how we need to do the same thing as he did because we can grow stronger. As Christians worldwide marked Ash Wednesday, the first day of the Lenten season, many attended church and received the imposition of ashes on their foreheads, like the students and parishioners at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Decatur. It really is a great way to kick off the season of Lent, said the Reverend Chris Comerford, pastor of St. Patrick. Like Jesus spent the 40 days in the desert, the church done this from a long way back, especially with the marking of the ashes, connecting us with that 40 days. It draws people in. People don't have to come today. It's not a day of obligation for Catholics. They choose to come. Ash Wednesday service and Lenten observance is sometimes bigger than Christmas, he said. This day just draws people, he said. During his homily, Comerford told the congregation that the ashes on the forehead, made from burning the palm leaves used to celebrate Palm Sunday last year, are a sign of repentance, that they want to change, they want to get closer to God. Giving up something for Lent, he said, should also include replacing that thing with faith practices, such as reading the Bible, praying, and serving others. If you give up screen time, fill that time with focusing on God. Pope Leo XIV suggested fasting from gossip and hurtful remarks, and Comerford said doing that and replacing those words with words of kindness and encouragement will help you become more like Jesus. It's a way that you can get close to God and show him how much you love him, said eighth grader Hazel Frazier. And her plan is to give up spending so much time inside, getting outdoors more instead. Principal Amy Yusko said the students at St. Patrick's School begin each day with prayer, and during Lent, each day will include a Lenten devotional. Students will be encouraged to observe the Stations of the Cross, a practice where believers walk through the church, pausing at each plaque depicting an event during the crucifixion. The students will receive a booklet explaining each station, she said, with suggestions for prayer. It's a way of putting them in the right frame of mind, Yusko said. It's a time when we turn away from sin and turn back to God. And Madison said her class is creating their own Stations of the Cross, making depictions of the events, and she's using two Barbie dolls dressed as Jesus and Veronica, a woman the Catholic Church remembers as having wiped sweat from Jesus' brow with her veil as he passed her on the way to Calvary. Tradition holds that an image of Jesus' face remained on her veil afterward. Other stations mark the moment he was condemned to death, the time Jesus fell, the people who spoke to him, meeting his mother Mary, Simon of Cyrene being compelled to carry the cross for Jesus, the moment of death, and when the body was laid in the tomb. Jesse Jackson. Jackson, last of a great era. Courtney Carson recalls meeting him during the Decatur 7 protests by Valerie Wells. Decatur. The news of the death of the Reverend Jesse Jackson hit Courtney Carson hard. It's been a rough morning, Carson said on Tuesday, the day the news broke that the civil rights icon had died at age 84. After a long battle with progressive supranuclear palsy. Carson met Jackson during the Decatur 7 protests in 1999, when seven teenage boys, including Carson, got into a fight at a Decatur high school football game. resulting in 2-year expulsions, which brought Jackson to the city to argue for less harsh punishments. Jackson offered all 7 boys a chance to complete their schooling and to receive his assistance in getting their lives back on track, which Carson accepted. He has since graduated college, been ordained as a pastor, and is now vice president of external relations at Richland Community College. Carson was instrumental in the founding of the Enrich program, which helps at-risk adults get training for careers that includes assistance with essential skills. Carson has been active in Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition and remained close to Jackson until the end. I've never teared up over death and funerals, and this one I can't stop tearing up, and I wish I could, Carson said. It just feels like he was the last of a great era, and even when he was there, just knowing he was present helped my heart, helped me transition. It's easy to say God does not make mistakes, and we shall not grieve as unbelievers do. It's easy to regurgitate scripture, but the reality of this thing, it hits hard, it weighs heavy. Carson plans to include a tribute to Jackson during the Enriching Our History Awards Gala on February 21st in the Schilling Center at Richland, and has already spoken to Mayor Julie Moore Wolf about issuing a proclamation honoring Jackson. He hopes to organize a local event in Jackson's honor as well. Jackson was a father figure to Carson, someone he could count on for advice, for correction, and for support. When no one answered the phone, he did, Carson said. He took me in and gave me so much courage, wisdom, and direction. He was the one, when I graduated college, he told me to come back to Decatur and make Decatur better. I cherish the moments when he had to chastise me, and when I did wrong, he'd correct me quick. He wasn't too big to check on the little people. When we sat down and talked with one another, he'd always ask about my children. He was always concerned about me being the best father I could be while trying to do this work. And when Carson and his wife Elise thought that they were done having children, Carson said, another one came along, a little boy that the couple named Chi Jesse Jackson Carson, because Jackson told Carson he was going to have one more child even before the baby was conceived. Without Jackson, Carson said he would not have been able to do any of the things he's done. And one of those things is that one of his fellow Decatur 7, Sean Honorable, has graduated from the Enrich program with certificates in HVAC and welding and is employed at Caterpillar, Inc. If Reverend Jackson hadn't saved my life, I wouldn't have been in a position to help Sean, Carson said. When we reunited with Reverend Jackson, Sean was smiling ear to ear. Honorable knew of Jackson even before the football game fight, he said, because he was so well known. But at the time, even with Jackson's offer to help the young men, he was just on a different path. While Carson kept in contact through the years, Honorable said he just wasn't ready to make the changes necessary. He's been in prison twice, and when he came home after the second incarceration, Carson reached out again, and by then he was ready. He had things going on, and that's all I could think about, Honorable said. It was like, man, he's doing the work Jesse wanted him to do, and I can see what he did. He passed it to Courtney, and Courtney imparted it to me. Jeffrey Perkins was a member of the Decatur Public School Board at the time of the incident, and was the only board member to vote against the expulsions. I felt that 2-year expulsions was way out of bounds. That's my take on it, said Perkins, who also marched with Jackson during protests against the decision. It turned into more than I ever dreamed of. Perkins has also served as president of the NAACP's Decatur branch and is no stranger to civil rights battles. It's not a way to make friends, he said. He got a lot of phone calls and messages from people who vehemently disagreed with him, and is willing to bet that Jackson, as a national figure, was accustomed to constant opposition. You fight for civil rights and hold people accountable, and people don't like you, Perkins said. Reverend Jackson had a long life, and did a lot of things, and a lot of people have stood on his shoulders. I am deeply saddened by the passing of Reverend Jesse Jackson, said Anthony Corey Walker, downstate president of the Black Chamber of Commerce of Illinois, and co-founder of the Ink Spot, the first African-American owned and operated business incubator in downstate Illinois. This morning, I personally reached out to his family to offer our condolences on behalf of the Walker family. My father shared a close friendship with Reverend Jackson, and our family has always held deep respect for his leadership and sacrifice. Walker and his father, the Reverend Thomas Walker, joined Jackson and Al Sharpton on a march in 2002 over the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. In 2002, when the younger Walker was 31 years old. That experience jump-started something in me, Walker said. It solidified my commitment to leadership, economic empowerment, and standing boldly for our people. Reverend Jackson was not just a civil rights icon. He was a living example of courage, persistence, and faith in action. His voice reshaped this country and gave strength to communities that often felt unheard. Beanballers Nod to Decatur Sports History by Will Foley, Decatur. The city's Prospect League baseball team has its name. After more than 1,000 fan entries were submitted with name suggestions, it's official. The Decatur Beanballers will take the field this summer. You've got to work within the confines of, hey, here are the major themes we're hearing. And for here, it was pretty simple. Soybeans and agriculture. Team chief storyteller Jamie Toole said, how do you make beans fun and tie it to baseball? Beanballers. The moniker is a nod to Decatur's identity as Soy City, or the soybean capital of the world, for the city's economic domination of soybean processing. At its peak, Decatur processed more than a third of all soybeans in the world in the 20th century. The soybean aspect, combined with baseball, resulted in an alliterative name that Toole tabbed as the right fit. Another angle Toole targeted was to tie in Decatur's history with the Chicago Bears, which originated as the Decatur Staleys. That's why many of the team's logo options, there are around 10 total, depict a cartoon bear. One of the current primary logos features the bear with a D chain around his neck and a baseball bat in his paw. To me, the demographic that we're targeting is moms and kids, Toole said. We want moms and kids to like it, like, let's go spend a summer night at the ballpark. I'm very proud of it, and I hope the community is too. The primary colors are lighter green and blue. The green, Toole said, is associated with crops and agriculture, while the milk is a nod to the club's partnership with Milliken. The Beanballers will open their season on May 26 at Workman Family Baseball Field. They'll play 28 home games and 28 road games in the Prospect League. Politics, Durbin, LaHood, Diagnose, Talk Political Healing by D. Jack Alkire, Lee.net. Normal. Two long-serving political stalwarts made the push for bipartisanship and a return to fact-based news coverage of governmental affairs Tuesday night in the first of five democracy dialogues in Bloomington Normal. Retiring Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Springfield and Peoria native Ray LaHood, former Republican congressman and transportation secretary for President Barack Obama, spoke to a crowd of roughly 400 in Braden Auditorium at Illinois State University in Normal. They answered questions on a wide range of topics, including social media, the state of journalism, gerrymandering, hyperpolarization of political lines, and the health of the democratic experiment in America. I'm an optimist, or I never would have gotten into politics, Durbin said, who announced last year that he will not be seeking re-election after 30 years in the Senate. I think what we're going through now is a test. We're being tested in ways about the Constitution that we've never been tested before. I always thought the greatest test, of course, was the Civil War. We fought and killed one another over the issue of slavery and states' rights, Durbin continued. But when it came down to this particular situation, we're dealing with challenges we have never, ever seen when it comes to our Constitution. I think we'll last in the challenge, but it will take a while. Key moments. LaHood, who represented Illinois' 18th congressional district from 1995 to 2009, said the Constitution has been the main guiding principle of the United States since 1788, as the nation celebrates its 250th anniversary. We are the beacon of hope and the beacon of light for the world, he said. People around the world want to replicate what we have done in our country, and the way that we've done it is we follow the Constitution. Nothing will ever be a better backstop for whatever happens. To that end, LaHood said, despite the conception of hard lines keeping elected officials in both the Democratic and Republican parties from reaching across the aisle, bipartisanship still exists. The majority of people who serve in the Congress serve to benefit the people who sent them there and to benefit the country, he said. There's a lot more bipartisan activity that takes place. There's a lot more bipartisan work that takes place that never gets the headline. Recently, President Donald Trump's Department of Justice sought to indict two sitting U.S. senators, Mark Kelly, Democrat Arizona, and Alyssa Slotkin, Democrat Michigan, on charges of seditious conspiracy related to the senators calling for military members to reject unlawful orders. A District of Columbia grand jury did not approve the charges. What they're going after, Kelly and Slotkin for, was an expression of free speech, which I think is pretty obvious, Durbin said. But that is an indication of the lengths which the administration will go to quiet its critics. I think it's an extreme example of a lack of respect for the respective branches of government. I hope we never see this happen again. Both Durbin and LaHood said the shift of news consumption from legacy media like newspapers and radio news to social media has added to an unreliable media atmosphere. Social media has allowed politicians and candidates to say whatever they want, right or wrong, true or false, about anybody, and not be accountable for it, LaHood said, something Durbin echoed. The source of information for the future is critical. If we don't have a healthy press, then we have nothing like many of us remember, Durbin said to robust applause. Where in the world can a conscientious person go to learn the facts and draw their good conclusions from them? That, to me, is troubling more than almost anything. Among the myriad issues that both men agreed on, there was one that seemed slightly contentious in the present day, gerrymandering. Solving the issue is difficult, because constitutionally, drawing legislative and congressional districts is delegated to the states and not the federal government. While Durbin noted there is a problem in the practice that allows whichever party is in power to draw political districts favoring their candidates, he acknowledged a gerrymander is what got him first elected in the 1980s to the U.S. House of Representatives. Decatur. Council no on more daycare money. By Tony Reed, Decatur. It was close, but in the end, the Decatur City Council decided that sinking another $124,877 of taxpayer cash into the proposed Love, Learning, and Laughter daycare facility was a bridge too far. The council, which is already in the hole to the tune of more than $1.5 million spent or pledged so far to set up the privately owned business, voted 4-3 Monday evening to reject spending a dime more on the LLLD project. That was a blow to the business owner, Sherry Johnson, who turned up in person at Monday's council meeting to ask for the extra money. But speaking after the council money, she said LLLD would still move forward and she would secure the money she needed herself. Love, Learning, and Laughter is committed to finishing this project, she told the Herald and Review. A report to the council by City Manager Melissa Hahn explained that the $124,877 was required to offset the ballooning rehabilitation price of transforming the defunct We Folks Child Care building on the corner of North Jasper and Orchard Streets into LLLD's new home. A stair chairlift, further roof repairs, and HVAC upgrades had all come in over budget. But it was only in October, however, that the council had signed off on a deal with LLLD to spend an extra $400,000 renovating the We Folks building. That was supposed to be the end of the taxpayer commitment, with a signed agreement stating any costs above and beyond that were down to LLLD, which could either pay for them itself or walk away from the deal. Johnson said original estimates for the rehabilitation costs had unfortunately later been revised downwards, creating the funding gap. But she said she bore no ill will towards the city. They, the council, have to do what's best for the city as a whole, she told the Herald and Review. So I'm not going to take it personally that Love, Learning, and Laughter didn't receive the extra funds. We're going to get this thing done for our city, because our children and our community deserve it. The council has consistently prioritized giving the LLLD project a massive helping hand because of the desperate need for more child care facilities in Decatur for shift working parents. LLLD's agreement with the city calls for it to open up within 2 years of finalizing a deal to rehabilitate the old We Folks building, and within 24 months of opening, to be operating a 24-hour daycare for shift workers' kids, something unique in Decatur's history. Councilman Dennis Cooper, who asked for the extra money request to be put on Monday's meeting budget, had earlier told his colleagues it was too late to pull out now. I think, long range, it's a win-win for our city. It's a win-win for the parents, a safe place for the kids to be while their parents are at work. Cooper was one of the three votes in favor of spending the extra money and was backed by council members Consuelo Cruz and David Horn. Horn said Decatur had made great strides in helping the city's fortunes with the recent introduction of a microtransit program. But he said the city needed to complement that with better opportunities for child care to help people hold down jobs and turn the tide on poverty, noting that some Decatur neighborhoods had the highest poverty rates in the state. Horn said shutting off financial help now risks seeing the whole project die. So if we vote no for this, what is our backup plan? He asked. See if another entity will own it, or just wait until it deteriorates and we have to demolish it, the We Folks building, and pay over $1 million to demolish it? The four deciding no votes were cast by Mayor Julie Moore Wolf and council members Pat McDaniel, Lisa Gregory, and Ed Culp. They all said the new daycare was needed, but taxpayers had done enough. Culp said that the last agreed payment of $400,000, voted in at the October meeting, was the final red line for the project, and it had to stay that way. We've put so much into this. We have so much belief in this need. We all do, he added. But at what point do we draw the line? I believe that was done with the last vote. Manslaughter defendant released before trial by Tony Reed, Decatur. As the victim's family members sat weeping in a courtroom, Christian D. Luthi was granted pretrial release Tuesday on charges he accidentally shot his girlfriend to death while playing around with an AR-15-style rifle on Valentine's Day. A sworn affidavit filed by the Decatur Police Department says the 25-year-old defendant's version of events is that he jokingly pointed the gun at Alexandra A. Wilson, 26, and pulled the trigger. He told police he believed the weapon which he had been working on was unloaded. He called 911, and patrol officers arrived at Luthi's Decatur home early Saturday evening to find Wilson suffering from a single gunshot wound to the torso. She was later pronounced dead at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Macon County Circuit Judge Thomas Griffith said his ultimate decision to grant Luthi pretrial release gives me great pause, but said he must react to the charges as presented. Luthi is charged with 2 different counts of involuntary manslaughter, class 2 and 3 felonies, and a further charge of the reckless discharge of a firearm, a class 4 felony. He has a FOIA'd card. Before making his decision to free Luthi, the judge questioned both prosecution and defense about the circumstances of the case. He asked defense lawyer Chidiberi Wachukwu if there is some other explanation. Would this AR-15 just happen to be loaded and just happen to point it at another human being and pull the trigger? Wachukwu said she was not aware of any other version of events. Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Scott Reuter had earlier argued that was the explanation police and prosecutors had now, but investigations were continuing. He said the speed with which charges had to be filed after recent legal changes meant prosecutors had to go with the information about the case as discovered by the police so far. Reuter said that much of the evidence came only from one source, Luthi. He is saying he was just joking around, I guess, when he pointed the firearm at her and pulled the trigger and believed the gun not to be loaded, Reuter told the judge. That may be the truth, it may not, he added, and, arguing for Luthi's detention, said that anyone who treats firearms in such a reckless manner is a danger to the community and deserved to be in custody. Granting pretrial release, the judge noted Luthi was employed and had no criminal record. He also asked whether the defendant had shown any suicidal tendencies, and looking at Luthi, said, "You know why I am asking, Mr. Luthi?" The judge was told no such indications had emerged so far. Luthi's release conditions forbid him from owning or possessing any firearms, and he is to report back to court March 11th for a preliminary hearing when he will enter formal pleas to the charges. Today in history, on this date, in 1473, astronomer Nicholas Copernicus was born in Torun, Poland. In 1847, the first rescuers reached members of the Donner Party, who had been snowbound in the Sierra Nevada near the California-Nevada border for nearly 4 months. In 1942, during World War II, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which paved the way for the internment of 125,000 people of Japanese ancestry, including U.S.-born citizens. In 1945, Operation Detachment began during World War II as the first wave of U.S. Marines landed at Iwo Jima, where they commenced a successful month-long battle to seize control of the island from Japanese forces. In 1976, President Gerald R. Ford, calling the issuing of the 1942 internment order for people of Japanese ancestry a sad day in American history, signed a proclamation formally confirming its termination. In 2003, an Iranian military plane carrying members of the elite Revolutionary Guards crashed in southeastern Iran, killing all 275 people on board. We'll take a short break now and return with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, February 19th, 2026. Please stay tuned.